And it's a Thursday afternoon, and glad to have you with us. As a heads up, today's show is pre-recorded as I'm out running errands here on this Thursday afternoon, but do have some great interviews lined up for you. As coming up, we are going to be speaking with Hamline University professor David Schultz about something he recently wrote in his blog, Schultz's Take, which you can find over at schultzstake.blogspot.com. It's about the need to build coalitions and how Democrats largely failed to do that back in 2016. And David and I share the same concern that Democrats could be making that same mistake here in 2020 on both the Bernie Sanders and the Joe Biden campaigns. So we're going to be talking with David about how both campaigns really need to expand their coalitions if they want any sort of chance of beating Donald Trump coming up this fall. So we'll play back that conversation with David Schultz coming up in the last segment of the show. You won't want to miss that, because no matter if you're a Bernie supporter or a Biden supporter, David and I both kind of agree that both candidates really need to expand that coalition to have any sort of chance at winning here this fall. Also ahead on the show today, we'll be speaking with the new Senate Minority Leader for the DFL, that's Susan Kent, who you might remember was recently elected the new DFL Senate Leader back in February, as we'll be speaking with her about a number of issues that have come up in the state Senate. One of them is, of course, gun safety reform, as Republicans recently held some hearings earlier this week, and what they're really trying to do is come up with a so-called bipartisan compromise bill, even though it's not much of a compromise. We'll be talking about the strategy that Republicans are trying to use and ways that the DFL will try to counter that, as they want to get their, of course, red flag laws and also universal background checks passed. So we'll talk with Senate Minority Leader Susan Kent about that, and also whether any Republicans might come on board and support those two provisions. And we'll also touch on a couple of other issues as well, including the coronavirus and then the need for emergency insulin funding. Have we finally reached a point where we could have a bill that makes its way all the way through the legislature and eventually gets signed by Tim Walz? That'll be a conversation with Senate Minority Leader Susan Kent coming up a little bit later on. But first, we're going to be talking about an issue that's really been highlighted in the news recently, and it has to do with support services at schools for providing mental health services for students. It's one of the reasons why the St. Paul Teachers Union has gone on strike recently, as they want to see increased support for students that are having mental health problems. And now this has made its way to the state legislature, where Representative Kelly Moeller has introduced a couple of bills that would help more teachers get training in terms of trying to help students with mental health issues. Now, to give us a preview on some of the efforts that are being undertaken in Minnesota to improve mental health support services in schools, this is a really good summary from Mike Moen of Public News Service that talks about these efforts in Minnesota.
Minnesota lawmakers, educators, and industry experts are demanding a more robust support system for students struggling with mental health issues. A proposed bill in the state legislature would expand the number of teachers who receive suicide prevention training when they need to renew their license. Currently, that requirement only applies to more experienced teachers. Blaine Police Chief Brian Padani says actions like this could help address the increased amount of stress students are dealing with these days.
25 years ago, it was hard enough being a kid. Now, we have kids that are dealing with more stressors than ever, and everything's coming at them from all angles, whether it's on their phone, whether it's their youth around them, whether it's the world we live in.
But Annie says in his community, 6 students have taken their lives this school year. In addition to the training bill, another measure would create a new position in the state education department to provide mental health guidance to districts. Hopkins High School junior Liz Steen says when she was a freshman, 2 fellow students took their own lives within 2 weeks of each other. She says there wasn't enough outreach to help the student body cope with a difficult situation.
Our needs for the school, for the grief that the entire school was experiencing, was not met.
According to the 2019 Minnesota Student Survey, the percentage of 11th grade female students who report having long-term mental health, behavioral, or emotional problems more than doubled from 2013. In that same survey, nearly 1 in 10 11th graders reported attempting suicide. Mental health experts say the issue is especially troubling for Native American students as well as LGBTQ students. Sue Abderholden heads the Minnesota chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. She says there no longer should be confusion among school districts on how to engage with students when there's a crisis. She says having a point person in the state education department will take away that confusion.
Districts will know who to call to obtain information about school-linked mental health, about the best trainings on mental illnesses, or the best practices about responding to a suicide in their school.
As advocates push for changes in the legislature, they say students need to be aware of resources that can help them deal with the mental health crisis. In Minnesota, they can seek assistance through the crisis text line by texting MN to 741-741. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
So coming up next, we're going to be speaking in more detail about some of these efforts to improve mental health services for schools in Minnesota, as we'll be playing back a conversation I had with Kelly Muller, who's authored a couple of bills that deals with this issue in the state legislature. That's on the way next on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, increasing support services for students in terms of mental health is certainly a very important topic that we've seen in the news recently, especially with the strike over with the St. Paul Teachers Union. And now that topic has also made its way to the state legislature as well. As Representative Kelly Muller from District 42A, which represents portions of the North Metro, has introduced House File 3001, which would allow more teachers to receive suicide prevention training. And Representative Muller joins us now on the program. Hey there, how are you doing today, Representative Muller?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so give us a summary of what is in House File 3001 and why it's needed, because it looks like right now only a certain number of teachers, and not all of them, are receiving suicide prevention training and recognizing that in students.
Yes, that's right. So actually, Minnesota was one of the first states to require teachers to have this suicide prevention training. And it used to be that all teachers were getting that training prior to relicensure. And what happened was the legislature a few years ago allowed for tiered licensure for teachers. So there's four different levels of licenses that different teachers can have. And for some reason, for this 1 hour training, they left off tier one and tier two teachers. So that means that only certain teachers now currently have to have that 1 hour of suicide prevention or mental health, mental illness training before their license is renewed. So this bill goes back to what it used to be before we had all the tiers and said, nope, to get your license renewed, we want all teachers to have to go through this training because it's so important.
What sparked you to write this bill? Were you hearing from teachers from around the state or other folks who were saying, hey, this is important that we should have this requirement for all teachers?
Yep, all of the above. So my interest level in this issue started back in 2017 when one of my son's good friends took his life in high school. And it wasn't the first time in our school district that happened. There had been several in recent years. And I started working closely with the community, with the school district, to start really talking about this issue. And at the time I was running for office, I wasn't elected yet. And I knew that as a policymaker, this was something that I could do something about. And so I continued to work with them. But then even last year, my first year in office, I heard from so many teachers, pretty much any educator who came and talked to me said their students are facing a mental health crisis and it's just not being addressed in the schools. It's in the school districts. It's one of their top concerns throughout the state. And then students themselves are telling us they have an issue. The student survey that was conducted by the Department of Health in 2019 shows that students have an increasing percentage of feeling depressed, anxious, and an alarming number of students who have seriously contemplated suicide in their lifetime.
And I even saw in the press release that was put out the other day just that shocking stat from the Blaine police chief, I believe, where they already had six students who have taken their own lives this year. The numbers are just, not good.
Yes, the numbers are terrible and alarming, and that community obviously is hurting and looking for some solutions. And just to be clear, this bill and another bill that passed in committee last night aren't going to solve all those problems. This is a comprehensive, we have to have a comprehensive approach to this, but there are two tools in the toolbox.
Right, absolutely, and it certainly looks like a step in the right direction. So how would these requirements be implemented, since it would seem like you would have a number of teachers who would now be receiving this type of training? What would that process look like, and who would be in charge of the training?
Yep, so that's a great question. The bill does another thing as well. It requires the school licensing board to create some standards around what is good training, what's evidence-based training. And so that will happen. There will be some standards that schools will have to meet to offer that training. We had the National Alliance of Mental Illness supports this bill, and they were last night in committee talking about the good training that already exists that's out there. So there are some of it's online training, some of it's in-person training. So districts will get to choose what type of training they want to offer to meet the requirements of the statute, but they'll be given some guidelines as to what the best practices are for that.
And I imagine the response, we kind of alluded to this already, the response from teachers and I'm guessing administrators has been pretty positive on this, correct?
Right. Yep, absolutely. And as you mentioned at the top of this, the teachers are really on the front lines in this, and our school districts are on the front lines trying to deal with this crisis and not having adequate resources to address what's going on in our schools.
So there's another bill working its way through that I would also create a new position. It would be the Director of Comprehensive Mental Health Services. Talk a little bit about this position and why you think it's needed.
Yep. So we, again, heard last night in committee from testifiers about the need for this position. This person would be housed at the Department of Education. And our testifier has done some research on this. 46 states, I believe, have a website that has information that schools can use or teachers can use, even families can use to find out what training is available, what other options there are. And we don't have that in Minnesota. And then I think she said 41 states have a position similar to this in their Department of Education. So what happened with our school district, when trying to look at how to address this growing mental health needs and the recent suicides, was looking to the Department of Education for some information, trying to find out what other districts were doing. And the only way for her to find out what other districts were doing was to start calling every single school district. And there are some districts who are doing amazing work. Several of them testified in our committee last night, but there's no way for them to really share that information across the state. And so this person at the department would really be a clearinghouse of information, finding out, doing site visits in schools, finding out what schools are doing that's really great, sharing that information with other school districts, looking nationally at what other states are doing, and then really gathering all that information and also creating a website so people can go and find what's out there.
Obviously, you guys just had the hearing last night, so it's pretty fresh in everyone's mind. But what's the response been from other legislatures, including Republicans or even the governor's office, if you've been able to read the tea leaves on that? What's been the response been so far from those different people?
We have bipartisan support. So the first bill, the teacher licensure bill, is being carried. They call it a clone bill, so it has a different number, but it's being carried in the Senate by a Republican. And then on the teacher position last night, that bill, I do have some other Republicans who are authors of the House bill. And both bills passed out of our committee last night with unanimous support. And they do have two other stops to make in the House. And I'm really hoping they'll both get hearings over on the Senate side.
Yeah, in terms of what happens next, it sounds like it eventually will make its way to the full floor of both the House and the Senate. And sounds like you're pretty optimistic that this bill could eventually end up signed into law.
I really hope so. I'm going to keep pushing as hard as I can. And if folks are listening and they care about this issue, I would just encourage them to contact their representative and senator and let them know that this is important to them.
Yeah, definitely. Sounds like an important bill. Both these bills that definitely should be enacted. We've been speaking with Representative Kelly Mueller. She is from District 42A, which represents portions of the North Metro area. Representative Mueller, thanks so much for the time today.
Thanks. And I just had one more thing to add.
Oh, sure.
Whenever I talk about suicide, I do like to provide the suicide hotline number, if you don't mind. Can I provide
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely, yes.
Yep, that number is 1-800-273-8255. And also, we have a text line. You can text MN to 741-741. So just if anyone's listening out there and needs that information, please know that help is available to you.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't even know we had a text line available, too, and I think that's really key. So, yeah, that's great information to give out, so definitely appreciate that.
All right. Thanks so much. I appreciate the time.
And if you'd like to follow along with those bills, again, they are House File 3001 and then House File 3219. Coming up next, we'll continue our look at the legislature as we'll be speaking with Senate Minority Leader Susan Kent about some recent hearings on gun safety in the state Senate, as well as some other topics. So stay tuned. We'll be speaking with Senate Minority Leader Susan Kent coming up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Right now, happy to welcome in Susan Kent, State Senator from District 53, which represents portions of the East Metro, and she is also the recently elected Senate Minority Leader for the DFL. Senator Susan Kent, welcome to the program. Glad to have you with us today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, definitely. So there's a few topics I want to go through with you. And the first one is what happened a couple of days ago at the legislature. And that has to do with the gun bills being proposed and gun safety measures that Republicans are trying to get through the Senate. Now, obviously, you guys have your own bills that you would like to see passed, including universal background checks and red flag laws. But talk about these bills that Republicans are proposing in the Senate. As I read through them, they're essentially strengthening laws that are already on the books, which are talking points we often hear from Republicans. Is that kind of the gist of what Republicans are proposing?
Yeah, I think you summed that up pretty well. I mean, this is working with what is already there and putting in basically some sort of technical enhancements, if you will, in the current law. But what we know from other states that have done the red flag laws, or as we call them, the extreme risk protective orders or the expanded background checks, is that those are the measures that really save lives and that really make a difference. And so, you know, if Republicans want to have, you know, hearings to look like they're doing something, these bills aren't necessarily bad ideas, but they're not going to solve the issue. They're not going to keep Minnesotans safe, which is what we're really committed to doing.
So essentially, yeah, what you're saying is that they don't go far enough in terms of actually trying to solve the gun issues we have in the state. Why do you think they don't go far enough?
Well, I mean, we're looking at data, right? Data has been collected in states that have enacted similar types of bills to expanding background checks and to the extreme risk protective orders. And we know that those actually save lives. There was a state, I think it was Missouri, that had the background checks and then didn't. They went away and then they came back and they realized they saw the difference. And we see similar sorts of cases in other states. The kinds of things that are being proposed here, They simply, as you said, they don't go far enough. They're just minor enhancements to some of the punishments and enforcement. It's not really going to keep guns out of the hands of people who we know are dangerous to themselves or others.
And as you alluded to as well, what I see them trying to do, the Republicans in the Senate, is pass this off as being, oh, well, we're going to try to pass this bipartisan measure so we could at least say we did something on guns. What's your kind of feeling on the DFL caucus, not just in the Senate, but also in the House? Is there any chance this could end up all going all the way through? Or what are you guys going to try to do to work public opinion to say, hey, these don't go far enough, and we think we have some better ideas for trying to get gun safety reform?
Well, the House has been, debating and hearing these bills in committee for a couple of years now. They passed them off the floor. We know, you talk about public opinion, we know that the background check bill has 90% support of Minnesotans. I don't know how you get much more bipartisan than that. And even, among gun owners, that number is well into the 80% range. Everybody agrees that there are people who, for all sorts of very important reasons, should not have guns because they're a danger to others or to themselves. But I think you actually explained it really well. The Republicans recognize that. They know that public support is not on their side on this issue. But they also don't want to go against the gun lobby and the gun manufacturers. And so they're trying to thread a needle here and act like they're passing something that will make a difference. But in reality, what they're proposing and what they're giving a hearing to, because they're not giving a hearing to the bills that we know make a difference, what they're proposing won't make a difference.
And the laws that you guys would like to see enacted are those red flag laws and universal background checks. Are there any other details we should know about these bills in terms of what they would do if they were enacted and signed into law?
Well, I think one of the things is what they don't do, because there's so much misinformation and fear-mongering about these bills. If people spend time with these bills, which if we'd have a hearing, we could actually go through them in great detail, there's all sorts of concerns that it creates some sort of registry or that we're taking people's guns away. That is not true. There are legal protections all over. I will give Senator Ron Latz great credit for having worked really, really hard with stakeholders on all sides of this issue to be very sensitive to the concerns. And so this is as common sense as it gets in terms of making sure that we are keeping guns out of the hands of people who we know are dangerous either to themselves or to others.
So are there any, do you think there could be any Republicans who could waver and maybe decide, all right, we are going to support these red flag laws or universal background checks, because there are a number of Republicans that are currently in the state Senate that are representing districts that saw their House seats go DFL in the last election cycle. Just kind of reading the tea leaves, do you think there are any Republicans who might switch what they would decide, how they would decide to vote on some of these proposals?
Well, I think the better way to look at that question is there may be Republican senators who want to vote for these bills, but the whole point of these bills that they just had a hearing on yesterday is to give them something they can vote for and not make the gun lobby mad.
Yeah, trying to have their cake and eat it at the same time. Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah, and try to thread a political needle here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if the Senate ultimately does end up changing control after the 2020 elections, I'm imagining if you would take over as Senate Majority Leader, these two bills would probably become top priorities next session, correct?
This is definitely something that we hear, like I said, 90% of Minnesotans support these measures. It is hard to imagine that keeping Minnesotans safe does not stay at the top of our list.
We're speaking with Senate Minority Leader Susan Kent, who is also a state senator from District 53, which represents portions of the East Metro. A couple more topics I'd like to talk about, and one is this emergence of a new emergency insulin bill that I know Senator Scott Jensen is supporting and trying to get through. What are your thoughts on this new compromise bill that we're seeing, at least from Senator Scott Jensen in the Senate? Are you optimistic we could finally see something get done on emergency insulin funding?
I'm glad that Senator Jensen has stepped into this with his knowledge and his commitment, I think, to trying to make sure that some of our pharmaceutical policies work better for Minnesotans. We need to keep the conversation going. Right now, and it gets a bit into the legislative weeds, but we've got two different bills, one in the House and one in the Senate. And so we need to get that sort of on track so that we can keep this
this process moving, because we know we need to act on this, because we have to provide both emergency relief to people with diabetes who desperately need access to these this medication, and we also need to have long-term solutions.
And then final topic to talk about today, and that, of course, is the coronavirus, which is expanding rapidly around the country. And at least here in Minnesota, what has me concerned is that, well, a lot of people who are hourly workers or those who don't have paid sick time could still end up going to work even if they're showing symptoms or might even have the coronavirus. Is there anything being worked through the legislature to try to help workers in terms of having that paid sick leave time if they do end up in that situation?
Well, the House is in the process of passing a paid sick time bill that would provide that very important leave to Minnesotans, because we know, and I think this is one of the things that has been really an eye-opener for so many Americans and Minnesotans, is that far too many people do not have access to time off if they're sick. And, I mean, particularly when you think about, like, people who work in the food service industry. I mean, that's a sobering thought, right? And for people who want to do the right thing, but they also are struggling because they can't feed their families if they don't go to work. It's a tough bind. So we are having those conversations. We're trying to figure out if there are things we can do. You know, we have a history when there are other types of disasters in terms of supporting people and businesses through whether it's, you know, low interest loans or different types of things. You know, we are looking at ways to provide some relief because public safety and public health here is very important.
Yeah, because I know a lot of Republicans probably wouldn't be on board with any sorts of permanent measures that would have to do with paid sick leave time. But I'm hoping at least, yeah, maybe something can come through in the short term or temporary basis, because that's exactly how this disease is going to spread if we end up having people that go to work that, well, have the coronavirus or have symptoms. And then, yeah, all of a sudden it gets spread around from there.
Right. We know, and I'm so proud of the governor, and I'm so grateful for legislative leaders and members working together. And the Department of Health and Commissioner Malcolm and her whole team are doing an excellent job. It's very evidence-based. It's very science-based. It's very thoughtful in terms of putting together the plans that we need to make sure that we are being responsive as we see how events unfold.
We've been speaking with Senate Minority Leader Susan Kent, who represents District 53 in the Senate, which is portions of the East Metro area, talking about some of the bills in the state legislature. Hey, Senator Kent, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Well, absolutely. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. Excellent. Got it recorded. Yeah, thanks again for the time today. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thank you for paying attention to these issues.
And coming up next on our final segment, we'll be speaking with Hamline University Professor David Schultz, talking political strategy and the need of both Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders to build coalitions with the nomination process going forward, especially with Biden, now that he really looks like he has an inside track to the nomination. We'll speak with David coming up next. Progressive voice of Minnesota, you're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, we're happy to welcome back to the program our frequent guest and political analyst, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. A reminder, you can follow his work over at schultzstake.blogspot.com. And Professor Schultz, welcome back to the program. Good to have you on.
It's always my pleasure to be on.
Absolutely. So your recent post over at your blog is something that well, really interested me, because it's always made me hesitant about both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, and it's about their ability to build coalitions. And you wrote about this in one of your recent posts, where you talk about how Biden has built a really broad coalition, except for having younger voters and liberals, while Bernie Sanders hasn't really done a good job building a coalition either. So talk a little bit about that. Let's start with the Bernie Sanders and how he needs to build a coalition to try to get back on track for his election chances.
what's exactly the issue at this point is we think about where Bernie Sanders sort of sits at this point. He's been very effective in this campaign, as he was 4 years ago, about mobilizing, I'm going to say, maybe 25 to 30% of the vote, maybe a little bit higher or something like that. It's been a coalition that has included, this year, Hispanics, young people, some white working class, but that's his core base. And that's who he's been able to turn out to vote somewhat effectively. And I'll come back and talk about what I mean by somewhat effectively in a second here. But beyond that, he hasn't expanded. And we saw that problem on Super Tuesday, where he just didn't really push much further than that core group of people. Conversely, what we're seeing with Joe Biden is his ability to hold together people of color, especially, let's say, older people of color and white moderates. But at the same time, even though it looks like he's expanding his net, he's not reaching out very effectively to young people and very effectively to Hispanics. And the only way the Democrats are going to win this November is if they put together the broad coalition. The broad coalition, which is what? The urban liberals, it is the people of color, it's going to be the young people, it's going to be those suburban women. That's the coalition that the Democrats need to be able to win. And so far, neither Biden nor Sanders seems to have figured out how to reach beyond their cores to bring in those other people that they really do desperately need to win.
Yeah, and looking at the Joe Biden side, what concerns me so much about him is that this seems like a big rehash of 2016, where Hillary Clinton, back during that primary of 2015-16, built up a similar coalition, and then ultimately she didn't have success in the general election because, well, there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm among those young voters. So I'm just afraid, is Biden making the same mistakes that Hillary made back in 16?
It's starting to look like that he is running as the Hillary Clinton candidate of 2020. Now, on one level, if we had just what, a straight popular vote for president of the United States, maybe that would be sufficient. Remember, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by approximately 2.5 to 3 million votes. Then you and I might not even be having this conversation. But the reality is that, as I keep telling people, it's the race for 270. It's the race for 270 electoral votes to win the presidency. And you have to think about how your coalition is dispersed across those critical swing states that would include places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and perhaps even Minnesota. And you're right. What we're not seeing is, in a lot of those critical areas, the enthusiasms. I mean, the way I've described Joe Biden, and hope nobody takes this as kind of a sexist or bad reference here, it reminds me of back in high school, you sort of had your safe date for the prom, but you were still hoping for your first choice, but you had your backup no matter what, maybe your next-door neighbor or something like that. And Joe Biden is the safe choice, but he's not the exciting choice that's going to motivate a lot of people. And maybe just simply being against Trump won't be enough to get those young people out to vote, especially, again, in those critical swing states that the Democrats have to pick up.
Well, I'll say it. That's a pretty accurate analogy, at least to me. And even if this coalition does end up working, like let's say we do head into November of 2020 with a bad economy, pretty much any Democrat will probably be able to knock off Donald Trump. But even if we look at that Joe Biden coalition, even as he goes into government and even as he takes over the presidency, it's tough to see that coalition lasting into 2022 and 2024. I would even see that as somewhat being kind of a redux of the Obama years where, yeah, that coalition might not last into those midterm elections and he could very well end up losing Congress.
I think you're right, and I think that's part of what happened with Obama is that in 08 he put together a great coalition, but it fractured very rapidly after the economy started to recover, and people sort of went in their different directions. And one of the things that I'm concerned about, and I saw this in 2016, and we're seeing it now in 2020, is that the fissure back then between Secretary Clinton and between Senator Sanders produced what? A generational split, that the young people who are going to be the future of the Democratic Party, starting now and going into the next few years, they felt like they were not listened to, they were excluded, that they were kind of pushed out of the party, and they didn't show up. And we're thinking about the same thing now, is that this is a fascinating election. Going into this election, the millennials and the Gen Zs are 37% of the electorate. They are the largest sort of generational blocks now voting, but they don't feel like they have inherited or own the Democratic Party yet, and feel instead that the baby boomers are still holding on and are coalescing behind what, a Joe Biden, much in the same way that they felt like that the party was coalescing behind Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. So the Democrats need to be figuring out a way, and I don't mean conniving, but really figuring out a way of what? Growing the future of the Democratic Party so that these millennials, these Gen Zs, become invested in the party, not just for 2020, but going down the line. Because otherwise, the Democratic Party is going to die off when the baby boomers die off.
And then the question becomes, is Bernie Sanders the person to lead that revolution, or the other, try to build a new coalition? Because even with him, it's tough to see him getting other more moderates on board with his platform. I mean, the great example would be right here, is that generally, if you're the president of the United States, you're sometimes only as effective as the Congress you get. And when I look at a Bernie Sanders, I would have trouble seeing him go to bat for someone like a Dean Phillips or an Angie Craig, where he could propose all of this great legislation, which, by the way, I agree with, but how is he going to get Congress on board and other portions of that Democratic Party?
And I think you're absolutely raised a great question here. Let's say he were to get elected and he wanted to go with a single-payer program, for example. I think it would be a very, very tough haul, just as you mentioned too here, to get Representatives Angie Craig or Dean Phillips to go along with it, simply because those districts are more centrist, and you're just not going to see some of these people give up their health insurance programs, which they're quite happy with. I mean, they may complain about the fact that, you know, the EpiPen or insulin's a little expensive, but at the end of the day, they're relatively happy with a lot of what they have. And so what I think we need to be seeing at this point, and especially after Tuesday today, where we're going to have a better picture where Biden versus Sanders might be at this point, is that the two of them need to start figuring out how they can work together. And what I mean by that is that at the end of the day, Sanders is not going to get, whether he is the nominee or he gets to be president, he's not going to get single payer. He's not going to get 100% on covering college education and a few of the other things that he wants, because the votes are not there in Congress. Conversely, Biden, where I'm not quite sure what he really wants in terms of a platform or what he wants in terms of a program, besides saying he's going to go back to the Obama era, he's not going to get the young people, the base to support him. So I would like to start to see ways where they can start to have a conversation and say, okay, what can we do to build a grand coalition going forward in terms of things that both can support? And this also speaks to our listeners here at the end of the day that, you know, in order to be able to win, to beat Trump, the Democrats are going to have to basically recognize the fact that what? It may not be single payer. It may be what? Public option. It may not be all college education is free, but what? Maybe 2 years are partially free, or fill in the blank, et cetera, et cetera. There may be have to be both sides. The progressives and the moderates are going to have to move to build a winning coalition. Because as I like to say, the first step in governing is what? Getting control of power, which means what? Winning the election. And if you don't win the election, you can't move your agenda.
Yeah, exactly. And even looking at hindsight here, were there any other candidates in the Democratic race that maybe could have had that type of unity and coalition building? I mean, what I'm specifically looking at is Elizabeth Warren, who was trying to build what you and I are kind of talking about right now, of uniting both that moderate and the liberal part of the party.
Yeah, and I actually thought at one point she was sort of positioned to do that, because You know, I hate to use sort of the Goldilocks story. You know, remember the Goldilocks and Three Bears? The bed was too big, too small, just right, et cetera, et cetera. And I was thinking that she was certainly not as progressive as Bernie Sanders on some issues or farther to the left. And she certainly wasn't of a centrist of the Biden Klobuchar. And I thought, well, maybe she becomes the reasonable compromise candidate that both sides could support in terms of saying that, yeah, you know, she embodies a lot of the policy ideas that I like. Certainly not everything, but she becomes the kind of the person we can agree on. And that's where I thought she had the best sort of positioning for herself. And for a variety of reasons, whether it was the sexism in the campaign, it was the fact that some people say that that Klobuchar and Buttigieg went after her really hard on how to pay for her health care plan, or whatever it may have been, she just didn't emerge as that compromise candidate that she could, or I think should have been.
So ultimately, whether it is Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden that end up getting the nomination as we get ready to close things out here on our interview, likely it'll be Joe Biden, but Bernie still does have an outside chance of getting that nomination. Right. Is their best chance for trying to build up that coalition going to come down to who they pick as their vice president? So, for instance, if it's Biden, does he need to pick someone on that more progressive side on the aisle?
I think the vice presidential becomes part of it to excite. And you're right. I do think it's more likely than not to be Biden, but certainly not ruling out that Sanders could still pull something off. But I do think Biden would need to be thinking in terms of a candidate that represents really the next generation for the Democrats, and also somebody who the left can get excited about. But also, I think it has to be reflected in what platform at this point. It's about what the party stands for and what it articulates in terms of its beliefs. So I think it's a combination of both the people who are selected and the campaigning narrative or platform. Even though I know many people say platform doesn't matter, but I think platform could signal, along with the right vice presidential pick, a way of building the coalition that I think ultimately either of the candidates, but more likely than not, I think the Joe Biden is going to need to be able to put together a winning coalition come November.
And ultimately, you can't just make that safe choice either, at least in my opinion. I thought Tim Kaine was one of the weakest vice presidential choices we've had in quite some time here in terms of picking those VP candidates.
I agree. I was going to say, I was expecting Clinton to do something bolder than that. I mean, the range of possibilities could have been, I remember 4 years ago, I was thinking of what, maybe a Julian Castro, for example, would have been a possibility. Or maybe you pick, although I was going to say Stacey Abrams certainly wasn't on the radar screen back then, but somebody like a Stacey Abrams, but somebody that would have excited the party. And Tim Kaine, nothing against him, he's a very competent senator from Virginia, but he certainly excited very few people, and he was almost of the same mold of Hillary Clinton. And sometimes, as your vice president, you want to pick somebody who appeals to a different aspect of the party in order to get them involved. And that would be my advice to a Sanders or to a Biden, is that use your pick to reach out to the rest of the party and to get the other part of the party excited about you.
That's Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. As we've been talking about presidential politics and the need to build coalitions, you can find Professor Schultz's work over at schultzstake.blogspot.com, among many other outlets. Hey, David, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
My pleasure, of course.
And again, highly encourage you to check out David Schultz's blog. You can find that over at schultzstake.blogspot.com. Well, that's all the time we got for today on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. I'm back with a live show tomorrow. I'll talk to you then.